days, when it comes to career development advice, I often recommend to people to find the intersection of two in-demand skills or topics and work to become an expert at that intersection. Dr. Roman Yampolsky, our guest on today's episode, has done just that by combining two of the most important fields of our time in tech, artificial intelligence, or AI, and security. After getting his associates at a community college, his master's at the Rochester Institute of Technology, and his PhD in computer science and engineering at the University of Buffalo, Dr. Yampolsky has spent the last 11 plus years as a professor of computer science at the University of Louisville. Along the way, he's published 100 plus articles focused on artificial intelligence and security, as well as several books in the field. Stay tuned as we deep dive into the career of Dr. Roman Yampolsky. Please welcome to the show, Dr. Roman Yampolsky. Doctor, great to have you on here.
Thanks for inviting me.
Again, so great for you taking some time. I know you've got a lot on your plate these days looking at, you know, what I gave there in the lead-in around security and artificial intelligence. There's a lot going on there. But I'm hoping we can start off just by having you introduce yourself to our audience.
I'm a computer scientist. I work at a university. And as you said, my interest is artificial intelligence. Specifically, I'm trying to understand how to control it, how to make sure it's beneficial for everyone. Pretty new field. Probably 5 years ago, it didn't exist. So I kind of helped to create the field I'm working in. And that's the best way to guarantee employment for yourself.
So as I mentioned in that lead-in too, you know, before you got into this work as a professor, right? You know, I'd love for you to spend a little bit more time on that education path, because I'm not sure if our listeners picked up on it, but you took just a little bit of a different path there from, I think, many. And you got your associates, then you went straight to master's, right? And then PhD. I'm kind of curious as to how that educational approach came together, when you got the inspiration to go get your PhD, and kind of all the questions that go into figuring out an education path for someone.
Right. So there are usually good deals. You can get some discounts by combining degrees. So I did a combined associate's and bachelor's degree. So you do 2 years at a community college, and then you get your bachelor's at a private university. And they had another deal. You go for another year, you get your master's. So that was pretty sweet. This way, you never get your bachelor's until you're done with your master's, but you get both at the same time.
Ah, interesting. Okay. So that's news to me even. I knew kind of you could do the 2 years and then get your 4 year. I didn't know you could combine all of that. I'm curious though, then, like, when did you have that moment of like, I'm going to go get my PhD? Because, you know, that's a lot of work. That's a lot of time in school.
I always knew that even before I started my associates, I was planning to do research. So I knew I'll have to do PhD work.
Well, so tell me a little bit more then, like, when in your childhood did this fascination with technology and computer science and doing research really start to emerge for you?
Early days, I was reading a lot of science fiction, and I always kind of figured it's going to be science, just give it 20 years and I might as well be the one working on it. So I always knew I'm interested in computers, robots, artificial intelligence. It was easy for me. I know a lot of people are confused. They change majors. They're not sure what to do with their lives. It was never an issue for me.
Was there a particular book you recall as a child? I'm just kind of curious.
Not really a specific book, just so many of them. I read foreign science fiction, American, between all of them, just general interest in getting this technology to work for us, to allow us to go beyond what a human can do.
No, that's fantastic. And I'm wondering, like, what age did you start programming? Because I know you've been doing a fair amount of programming in your work, I'm sure. Like, at what point did you start programming?
Pretty late. I didn't see my first computer until I was like 15. I played a bunch of video games. Maybe that helped a little, but I didn't program until later.
Those of us of a certain age who aren't, you know, quote unquote, digital natives, video games were the gateway drug into this career, right?
Right. I mean, my initial plan was to develop games. I just later realized I can do something else, but that was the initial attraction.
Well, and so then I'm kind of curious, you know, this, you mentioned, you know, hey, you knew you were going to do research right from the get-go, and getting a PhD, being a research assistant, kind of this whole publisher perish side of academia, you know, that's pretty grueling, right, in terms of the workload, et cetera. I mean, I'm curious if you wouldn't mind sharing a bit on how you approached that whole process, that whole part of your career path? Like, how did you develop the work ethic around it? How did you know what you wanted to work on, what you wanted to research, all of those pieces? How did that emerge for you?
I'm lucky. I actually enjoy doing it. So for me, it's not a negative. It's not hard work. It's like my hobbies and interests just happen to be what I'm doing for a living. So I'm not a workaholic. I actually do fun things. I just get paid for them. And this way, you never work a day of your life, right? You're always doing interesting things, reading interesting books, writing papers on topics you find fascinating, and it's never a problem.
I could definitely relate to that. You know, that the joy that comes from working in a field that you really like, right? And I think in many ways, that's what this show is about, is trying to help people find that. I mean, so on this topic of AI and security, when did that emerge for you? I sense from your science fiction, et cetera, you've kind of always had this view for the future. When did that kind of get concrete for you during this process?
So my advisor was working on a lot of security and biometrics, specifically behavioral biometrics. And so it made sense to combine that with my interest in artificial intelligence. And as I realized, okay, we're going to get more and more capable intelligent systems. We'll have to keep up. Security systems, safety has to become scalable, more advanced. So it was a very natural progression towards what I'm doing right now.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. But for our listeners, fill in a little bit on what is biometrics about these days, and then we'll get to the AI and kind of the combination of security. So maybe a little bit more on the background.
Sure. So classic biometrics are physical biometrics, recognizing fingerprints, faces. Behavioral biometrics have to do with how you do something, how you walk, how you talk, how you sign documents. So more of a profiling of certain behaviors over time.
So were you, like, in that early research work, were you doing, like, building devices or more like just using the devices that were available to do interesting things?
Just algorithms for doing pattern recognition. So let's say you do have a sample of a face. Can you match it to one from a database? Can you figure out if it's partially covered, who it is, and things like that?
Gotcha. And so I imagine then those early days, like those were all machine learning approaches, right, too? You're doing statistical sampling of data that's coming off of these devices?
Oh, it was even before like machine learning as we know it today, deep networks. A lot of it was kind of manually designing features, extracting them, trying to give them proper weights. Now it's very different method. It's mostly hands off. You find enough data, you find enough compute, it just kind of works. Back then you had to figure out what to extract and how to get it to work, how to make it invariant and so on.
Yeah, it's amazing how far this field has come. And I mean, I guess maybe that's a good segue into a little bit, because I think, you know, at least the research I've done, you know, a lot of where you're focusing your effort is around, okay, you know, there's all this hype in artificial intelligence, machine learning, et cetera. And then your take on it, at least to date, as far as I can tell, has been around like, all right, how do we make this safe? You know, how do we avoid Skynet? How do we avoid Terminator as the most extreme examples? But I'm wondering if you can kind of fill our listeners in a bit more on this intersection between security and artificial intelligence and what kind of problems you're trying to work on to understand.
Sure. So Skynet is kind of military doing it on purpose. They're developing killer robots, automated drones. Most of what I'm interested in is not military applications of AI, but you're designing a product or service, a very benign product relying on artificial intelligence, but you make a mistake in your design, in your code, in how you approach training. And as a result of it, the system misbehaves. It has certain side effects. And if it's, let's say, a spell checker, it will correct the words incorrectly. If it's a self-driving car, it will kill someone. Depending on the product, it could get really bad. And how can we predict those accidents? How can we avoid them, classify them? And as the systems become more and more capable, we can look at the future. If they become as smart as we are, smarter, is there anything we can do to control them, to make sure they do what we would like them to do?
You know, I had a friend of mine who always said, you know, Grant, like, how do you measure something that didn't happen, right? And so I'm kind of curious, like, how do you approach this problem? Is this primarily about making sure all systems have adversarial examples fed into them? Like, how do you approach this problem in terms of solving all these different attack angles, this these unintended consequences?
Well, it's not a single problem. There are thousands of sub-problems, and we keep discovering new ones. And so a big part of my research is not so much fixing things, just pointing out how things can go wrong for a specific type of algorithm, specific product. Just having a database of historic accidents, what happened in the past, is already helpful to kind of predict what we might expect in the future. But there is not a single solution to all those problems. We're still not sure just how many different types of problems there are. So part of what I do is creating classification systems for different AI failure modes and trying to predict for future systems, systems we don't have today, smarter systems, how can they fail and what can we do about it?
What are some examples of like the way these things fail?
So for current systems, basically the simplification algorithm is if a system is designed to do X, it will eventually fail to X. Give me an example of a product and I'll tell you exactly what it will fail to do, right? It's just common sense. Famous examples we have, Microsoft designed a chatbot called Tay. The goal was to deploy it on social media and have it talk to teenagers so they teach it how to speak English and have fun with it. Can you guess what happened?
Funny, I was just thinking of this exact example. Do tell the rest of the story for our audience who maybe hasn't heard it.
So it very quickly, within hours, became ridiculously obscene, racist, sexist, just terrible because people were feeding it all sorts of garbage data. And if you read my papers, you would know not to do that. Don't allow random users to inject data into your intelligence system. But Microsoft, a somewhat respectable company, failed at that. And it was a publicity nightmare for them.
I mean, it's kind of curious. Like, you've obviously maybe looked into that one in more details. I mean, where did it go wrong?
Use cases. When you develop a product, you think, oh, users are going to use it for this purpose. Whereas, did you consider how else they can use it? Like in America, they always have this labels on products. Do not put it in this place. Do not do it that way. Because people do. Whatever the product is, they'll find ridiculous ways to abuse it. And you need to know that ahead of time and get ready for it.
Don't look over this cliff too closely. Otherwise, you will fall to your death. And yet people still do it. You know, I mean, that's obviously a really big kind of, everybody can look at it and see, oh yeah, ha ha, dumb Microsoft, right? In that moment. You know, one of the things I often see in my field of search is like, there's some more subtle biases that come in with these systems. Like all else being equal, people will click on the thing at the top of the page before the next thing on the page. I'm kind of curious, is that also considered part of this work of kind of detecting those lower level biases?
Well, bias is certainly a type of a problem with intelligence system, especially it's some sort of illegal bias. You're not allowed to use that. Certain biases are just learning patterns, right? So heuristics, which are useful, but others we don't want to see. In search, it's possible that the search algorithm learns based on what people click and what they do to display certain results. So if majority of people are kind of dumb and just click on fake news and pseudoscientific articles, that's what's going to end up at the top of the search. Is that a successful search or it's providing what users want? They click on it more, but the information you get is garbage.
That's a perfect example of kind of some of the stuff I've seen in my career. I'm kind of curious then, like, first part of this is you've talked about building up this classification of, you know, it's almost like a taxonomy of all the ways humans can be stupid with AI. You know, how do you dovetail that with actual things that people can do to prevent that? What's the research look like on helping people actually do something to fix this?
Well, it's actually not what I did. I'm looking at stupid things AIs can do. I didn't even touch stupid things humans can do. That would be a much larger paper. There is no limits to human stupidity. But with AI specifically, we're looking at how they are different from human intent, human common sense. And just looking through those examples helps you as a designer of a system go, well, we didn't consider this. What if they do that? Should we have this in place? Just kind of gives you a chance to see this alien intelligence because you go, well, who would think that's a possible solution? But a computer doesn't have human common sense. It finds closest, cheapest available solution in a space of possible solutions. And how it gets there is not always what we would like to see.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And so, like, I'm curious then too, because how do you think about balancing out? Obviously, there's a lot of benefit for us as humans having the computer do, you know, this drudgery work or this rote categorization work, or just being able to rip through a million examples in an hour. I'm wondering then, how do you look at it from kind of the other angles of balancing out where the benefits are with the risk side of it? You know, do you have a framework in place? How do you think about that part of it?
It's not easy. And I specifically concentrate on long-term and more powerful systems. So the benefits would be huge, but the side effects are also existential risk, essentially. So it's not obvious how to just do it as a utilitarian calculus. Okay, we get that much dollars, but we lose that many lives. There is not a clear solution to that. My hope is just to cover this empty spot. Almost everyone is doing development to just get the systems to work. Okay, we got accuracy levels to 99%, we're deploying it. But very few people actually work on the other side of making sure it works as intended.
And that makes a lot of sense. I mean, so by longer term here, I mean, are you specifically focused on more, you know, let's call it human level intelligence for these systems? Or is it just like the next iteration of, say, some of our deep learning algorithms or whatever?
Yeah, my main interest is human systems and beyond that. And it seems that the moment we get to human level, very quickly we get super intelligence just from what is already given. Basically, infinite memory, high speed, access to knowledge on the internet. So it would be a very quick transition, in my opinion.
And then, of course, the rapid ability to replicate its knowledge to other...
Right. Parallel number of agents, speed of compute, all that. Yeah.
In the news, you know, obviously you hear a lot of hype and doomsday around this. I mean, kind of what's your take about where the current state of this is versus, you know, this horizon you're talking about? I'm not asking for prediction by 2025, we will have this, but I'm just kind of curious as to how you think about where we are versus when we would get there.
Right. That's a great question. And I think it's a good time to bring up the pandemic we're dealing with right now. And it's kind of like that. It's exponential progress, exponential growth. So right now we have 1,000 cases, 30 people dead. That's nothing for a country of a third of a billion, but it's growing exponentially. So in a month, if it doubles every 3-4 days, that's a lot of people. And it's kind of the same with AI. Today, we don't have much. They're kind of dumb and at best know how to do something in one narrow domain. But they are growing exponentially. It's a digital technology. It's increasing in speed, amount of data, and capability very quickly. So I anticipate such systems in my future, in your future, not just for my grandchildren.
I'm curious then, like, is somebody doing research in this area, like, how do you model that, right? Because you mentioned earlier you weren't really studying human systems so much, other than maybe some more intelligent animals. Those are the only models we have in front of us. Like, is this simulations? You know, how do you approach that?
Right. So it's a great question. And in many ways, human model is wonderful. It teaches us that there are no safe humans, right? You cannot create a safe human. So that's already very discouraging. Not a problem in itself. If you think about computer science, early computer science, Alan Turing's work, they did most of it before computers existed. For example, take Turing test. How do you determine if a machine is in fact intelligent? Well, that was proposed before anyone had computers available to them, essentially. So in a similar way, we can make predictions and assumptions about what are those superintelligent systems going to be like in terms of different properties and how that impacts their performance and how can we today control their development.
In controlling their development, would that basically prevent the superintelligence from appearing?
Preventing would only be useful if we agree that it's impossible to control them, to make them beneficial, so they are net harmful, and then you would work on reducing what they are capable of. But I think at this point, we're still hopeful that we can make them nice.
Yeah, I mean, when I'm having my dystopian sci-fi, like cynical view of the world, right, in some ways, I think that maybe humankind is the first species to create its replacement through this type of approach. Is that kind of what we're talking about here? That would be the Skynet worry, right?
Right. Essentially, we're the first to do it on purpose. If you accept evolution, then previous human-like species existed, and then we took over. So they also helped to create the replacements, just not on purpose.
So what's your take on this? You know, I know you've written a book on it. Maybe tell us a little bit about the book and kind of the current thought process here in terms of, you know, where the state of this field is.
Right. So I'm studying lately different limiting results and what is possible with intelligent agents. Things like limits to explainability, predictability, controllability of those systems. And it seems that there are some very specific results. So for example, if a system is smarter than you, you cannot predict what it's actually going to do. And by definition, if you could, you would be just as smart. If it's in terms of explainability, there are limits to what the system can explain to us and what we can understand. So even if it's making good decisions, it doesn't necessarily mean that we know how it's making them.
Yeah, well, and humans often can't even explain their own decisions either. So that bar is a pretty high one as well, right?
That's an excellent point. And since the system's artificial neural networks based on our natural neural networks, it's not even surprising.
Sometimes, you know, I see the work being done on explainability, and I think it's a good cause, right? And we should work to make efforts there. But we as humans can't even do it either. So at least, you know, we often post-rationalize, right?
Right, right. And there are some interesting projects, but usually they come up with simplifications. They never give you a perfect explanation. They'll give you top five reasons why it's true.
Yeah, or they just spit out a bunch of weights and say, see, isn't it obvious?
That's even less of an explanation, yeah, if it's machine readable only.
You know, shifting gears a little bit, I mean, you know, these days you're on the other side of the PhD gauntlet, if you will, as a professor. You also, you know, you're writing books, you're doing some public speaking. I'm kind of curious, you know, as you look at all this, like, fill our listeners in on the day in the life, if you will, of a professor, right? Because I'm assuming you're also teaching classes, or at least some, you probably have some.
Yes, of course. So teaching is a big component of being a professor. You teach multiple classes. Luckily, mine are related to my research. I teach artificial intelligence course as well. So it's all connected. You can recruit good students through your courses. You can introduce your research topics in your class. So it's all interconnected.
I've done some work in a research lab at a university in a prior life of mine. And one of the things that always amazed me of folks like you as professors of like this balancing act, if you will. I'm curious though, like, how do you approach doing deep work? Because, you know, you've got classes, you've got postdocs, you've got graduate students, you got your lab to run, et cetera. But then you also just need to do some really deep thinking on what we were just talking about. How do you craft your day to do that kind of uninterrupted work?
I had to kill multitasking. Basically, that will never work. Find a way to kill it. Do one thing at a time if you have to split it in different days of a week or work on one project at a time. But for me, that's the only way to get anything done.
It reminds me of my episode 6 on this, I think, with Fred Stutzman, who is, while he was doing his PhD, he ended up writing an app that went on to become a business where he just turned off everything on his computer and phone and all of that kind of stuff. So sounds kind of similar to your approach there.
Yeah, you have to learn to prioritize. You have to cancel certain things out completely. Just there is no time for them and they are not a priority.
Right. And then a lot of this model, right, I'm sure, is as you get promising students coming into your lab, for lack of a better word, a lot of your work then, I imagine, goes into figuring out what you can delegate to them. How can you bring them along in their thesis work, if you will, into kind of the research fold?
Right. So student supervision is a big part of what we do, absolutely. And I try not to give my students those crazy projects with super intelligence and whatnot. So they do more standard engineering work most of the time.
Ah, interesting. So you kind of just carve out that one area, this future work really is geared as solely in Roman's camp, if you will?
Essentially. I mean, they have to defend their work, PhD defense. You don't want them in a position where they defended something less than accepted by community today. I'm happy to take 5 years to get there. They don't have that time yet.
Yeah. What's that saying in academia? Something like get your PhD done, innovate later or something along those lines.
That sounds about right.
I'm curious then too, like, you know, a big moment in a lot of professors' lives is this, you know, getting tenure and kind of the lead in and through that. I'm gathering, given your time at Louisville, that you've gone through that process. What advice would you give for people who are kind of in the thick of that?
I'm a bad example. I basically broke every piece of advice. Basically, don't do what I did and you'll be successful. They tell you to stick with one topic. I jump from topic to topic. They tell you to, you know, don't worry about teaching, concentrate on research. I'm putting a lot of effort to be an excellent teacher. So I'm a bad example.
But counterexamples are also useful as well. So I appreciate you sharing that. Roman, I'm curious, what's been the most surprising thing about this path you've been on to date?
I always assumed it's going to get better in terms of free time at some point. Like I thought, once I get my PhD, I'll just have all this free time. Or once I get tenure. But now I realize it's only getting worse and it's going to keep getting worse.
And why is that? Because, like, you know, this field you're in, you're kind of at the forefront of some really challenging topics. Is it due to, like, the demands on your calendar?
Right. So as you become more accomplished, there is more demand on your time, your ambitious growth in terms of how many conferences you can give talks at and how many book projects you can accept. So in a way, you're volunteering for it, but you have much less time.
Well, so tell me a little bit more, you know, kind of put on the author hat and the public speaker hat, because that's not necessarily required of the role, but yet, you know, you've done it. It obviously can bring in benefits in terms of funding and all of that, but I'd love it if you could just reflect a little bit on that side of your brain, if you will, and that side of your work life.
Well, I really enjoy sharing my research, not just with other scientists, but with many intelligent people. So writing a book is a great way to accomplish that. Most people won't read research papers, but they're happy to pick up a book. If you want to meet them in person, you can go to conferences, give a talk. Usually they'll fly you to some nice place. So it's a pretty good deal for everyone.
Yeah, for sure. In fact, I was just talking to one of my researchers earlier who was like, hey, I'm about to go to a conference in Hawaii. And then, of course, was going to be canceled because of the whole COVID coronavirus thing. You know, one of the other curious things around, in particular, this field you're in, where you're looking at, let's call them negative events or events that, you know, are less than beneficial. I'm not even sure how to properly ask this, but like, how do you manage the, like, hey, the world's always falling view that sometimes can emerge from people who work on kind of these problems? How do you kind of balance out, like, hey, not everything is bad? Right? Because sometimes in this field, right, if you're constantly looking at how do we make sure we don't outdate ourselves or be taken over by, you know, evil AIs or something, you know, like thinking about negative, the way things can go wrong all the time could be depressing, right? Like, how do you manage or think about that side of it?
Well, I think I treat it like a video game. It's a difficult level, but I think I can beat it.
Yeah, no kidding. That's fantastic. On that note, you know, one of the questions I love to ask of all my guests, you know, is kind of this premise, you know, you mentioned earlier, hey, you love your work and therefore it's not even really work, but curious if you reflect, what's the best thing about the role and what's the most challenging? Like, even if it is a great role, you know, what is the most challenging? What's the best part of it?
So freedom. I get to decide what I do with my time. I can pick any topic and do research on anything I want. That's also the most challenging part. You want to pick something very important, very impactful, and something you can actually make progress on, help people.
Explain the freedom a little bit more, because like, does that mean, like, as a tenured professor, like literally tomorrow, if you said you wanted to go spend the next 2 years on blockchain, your university would just be like, hey, Roman, go for it?
It's not so much freedom, like move somewhere and not teach, but in terms of what topic I can do research on, there is a lot of academic freedom.
And is that primarily hinged on the tenure question like it used to be, or is it different these days?
So tenure basically allows you to have that freedom. Pre-tenure, you can still do it, but you probably won't get tenure if you pick some crazy topics.
Like it's too far out?
I gambled. I did this type of work pre-tenure and it worked out, but I wouldn't recommend it as a general strategy.
You choosing to do that ahead of time, kind of you saw this coming is basically the impetus for you getting into that field?
That, and also I figured, you know, I'm going to spend 7 years, no matter what, trying to get tenure. I might as well do something I actually enjoy.
Now that makes sense. I like to call myself a cynical optimist, and I sense a little bit of a kindred spirit here when it comes to technology. You know, in other words, I believe in what tech can do for the future, but I'm also cynical about any particular part of it, especially when it gets overhyped. you know, as someone who is doing a lot of research in this area, you know, how do you see this evolving over the next, say, 5 years in terms of the actual work you're doing?
So I'll continue looking at the limits of what's possible, specifically concentrating on control engineering. What is possible in terms of control? Can a lower intelligence control higher intelligence, and to what degree? If not, what limiting factors do we need to add to that agent to make it more controllable? So a lot of theoretical work, not so much building systems, but theoretical work on AI.
You know, I mean, there's some like human-animal relationship is, you know, somewhat of a model, although, you know, there's obviously ethical questions there too. You can imagine even, you know, speaking of the evolution earlier, when there was a mixture of humanoids and earlier man, et cetera, like as kind of examples in history where there's different levels. Is that kind of part of the modeling here as well?
Well, it helps to look at history. And if you look at history, all this, the higher intelligence, more advanced culture took over lower intelligence, less developed technologically culture, and it didn't end well for the less intelligent ones.
Yeah, a lot of deep stuff there, Dr. Yampolsky. I want to finish up with, and let you get on with your day with a couple of final questions. And the first one here, you know, the show is called Developmentor. And I know when you're getting your PhD, you obviously have advisors, et cetera. I would love for you to reflect a little bit on some mentors you've had and kind of some of the lessons you've learned from them.
So I had multiple good people, but they were good in different ways. And I think that's the secret. You're not going to find some perfect role model. Take something good from a dozen people and kind of like create this virtual entity. So this person is very good at teaching. This one is great at research. This one is a good friend. Get the best of all worlds.
The super intelligent advisor. Yeah, I love it. And then, so let me flip that question around and ask you to put on your mentoring hat. And you know, especially as somebody who is in this role of advising students, you've given some counter examples. What do you tell them as kind of your best career advice?
There is always exceptions. Every rule has an exception.
So for instance, how does that manifest? Is that literally kind of the, hey, know when to, you know, not follow the path on a certain type of approach when you're doing, you're trying to get tenure? Is it that kind of exception?
Just in general, if you look at the world, all the successful people, successful companies, they didn't necessarily follow the rules. They found some exception. So look at modern companies. I don't know, take something like Uber. They didn't go asking permission or Airbnb. They just kind of did it. And let's see if it works. Let's see if they shut us down.
Dr. Yampolsky, so great to have you on the show. Final question. Where can our listeners best follow you on social media or learn from you? Maybe dig in a bit more on these different approaches you've taken to your career.
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm Roman Yam, Y-A-M. You can follow me on Facebook. Just don't follow me home.
I love it. What a way to wrap up. Dr. Yampolsky, thank you again for joining me today. It was so great to have you on the show.
My pleasure.
Thank you, as always, to our listeners for taking the time to listen. If you like the show, we'd love for you to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or whatever your favorite podcast app is. You can also visit us at developmentor.com to hear older episodes as well as find other content on careers and technology. Most importantly, if you like this show, please tell your friends. Referrals are the lifeblood of any podcast. If you have any feedback on this episode or any episode, or you'd like to be a guest, drop us an email at podcasts@developmentor.com. Finally, we here at Developmentor hope that each and every episode helps you move that one step closer to finding your path.